Welcome to Wellness Spring. In this lively episode, I chat with Annie Spoker, a passionate psychiatric nurse who walks humbly beside her clients with heart, humour and grit. She opens up about the raw reality of nursing, the long hours, emotional toll and the invisible work most people would never see. Annie also runs Mama Spoke, her spicy soul food brand that's all about community, connection, and love. Having walked a similar path, this conversation lit me up and warmed my soul. Tune in if you'd like to feel inspired, moved, and maybe even a little bit fiery. Welcome to Wellness Spring. It's so lovely to have you on the show, Annie.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here with you, Beverly.
I'm sure it's going to be a very lively conversation since we've got so much in common with both psych nurses, and I did a short stint in drug and alcohol. And I've also owned a catering business and organized lots of events, which is right up your alley. So
Definitely.
before we get stuck in, because everybody loves a good story, do you mind telling the listeners where you grew up and what led you to choose such a tough but rewarding field like psychiatric nursing?
So I guess I don't know if I haven't. There was never a moment where I was like, this is why I want to be a nurse. But to start from the beginning, I grew up, I live in Bondi area now, but I grew up in Glebe and I miss Glebe. I loved growing up there. It was a very good place to grow up in terms of location. But I have a twin brother and an older brother. My older brother's overseas. And I grew up in, you know, just regular household, went off and did nursing. I don't know. I couldn't tell you why I wanted to be a nurse. I just know that from about year 10, I wanted to be a nurse. No one in my family works in the medical field. I don't know where it came from. I ended up getting into nursing. I did my enrolled nursing course first at TAFE, and it was at a time 23 years ago now when there was a big shortage of nurses. There's still a big shortage now and we all deserve a massive pay rise. It's terrible at the moment, but I got paid $400 a week to go off to Meadowbank TAFE and do my enrolled nursing course. And that was fabulous because most of the training was in hospital. You would have 8 week stints at the TAFE and then you would be in hospital, I think, for 8 week blocks, if not longer. So a lot of it was hands-on learning, which for me is a great way to learn. And you're just doing it. I think a lot of nurses come out of university, you know a lot, there's lots of theory, and then they end up on the wards and they're like, oh my gosh, I have to empty bedpans. This is not really what I thought this was going to be. And obviously it's not just about that, but there's so much nitty gritty. We do so much for people and it's an amazing job. But it was interesting for me, the difference between enrolled nursing study. When I went and was an RN, I started working as a registered nurse at RPA, fabulous hospital, and kind of the attitude from older nurses about me and nurses my age, because we'd come out of university, was like, oh, you think you're so good. It's like, well, none of us do, and we all need to look after each other. And I was an EN. I did have kind of similar training to you where a lot of it was on the ward, but just, you know, there's so much. I get very tangential, by the way. I'm going all over the shop. I appreciate that. But I just always wanted to be a nurse. And when I started, I was like, okay, this is what nursing is about. I'd never been in hospital. You know, I don't know why I wanted to be a nurse. But 22 years later, like I've been a nurse for 22 odd years now, it's a great gig and I never want to leave it. And I think the reason that we all love it, or most of us love it, there's obviously not great people in every industry and job, but the majority of nurses are just absolute beast humans, and we all deserve a pay rise, but we all stay even though the government's not paying us, because we love our jobs and I love my team as well. But I don't regret it. I'm really happy that I did it. And even though I've now got a side business, which is partially because I love food and I love making food, and it turns out people like my food, which is very nice, but nursing doesn't pay the bills, unfortunately. And I work 2 days a week, two long shifts. I do half a week's hours in 2 days because because I've got little kids and it kind of works for my family for me to not be out of the house 40 hours or 5 days a week. So I have a side business and it's going really well. So both together, I kind of don't want to lose one. I think nursing really humbles you and keeps you very realistic about the life that you lead, being very privileged generally versus the lives that other people lead. Whether it be less privileged because of health reasons or because of, you know, societal, social reasons like where they grew up and economics and stuff. Just, I would like to always be a nurse in some capacity. But yeah, it's great. And I ended up in drug and alcohol, frankly, because I didn't want to do shift work anymore. I knew nothing about drug and alcohol, but I wanted to work 9 to 5. I wanted to be able to plan what I wanted to have a free day in Tuesday in 2 weeks guaranteed. Whereas when you're shift working, as you would know, we used to get 2 week rosters. I think it's 4 now at a minimum in public, which is a nice change. But I was, you know, 18 to 30 working in the public sector, and it affected my social life, unfortunately. So drug and alcohol I moved into, no idea what I was in for, and it's great. It's so great. And I will be there, I think, till I retire or they kick me out.
Well, you unpacked a lot there. It's funny you mentioned RPA, because when I first came here from Wales, my first job was at RPA, and it was when they were changing from hospital-based trained nurses to university. And I was in charge of a ward, and I was horrified because people didn't have a clue, like you said, about bed bathing and changing bed, you know, giving bed pans and doing the basics. And they were checking the urine down the sinks and all sorts of horrible things. It was like, oh my God. And that motivated
I have to admit, I went to do that once when I was very new. It was like the nurse that I was with was horrified. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I don't know where it's meant to go. That was a very long time ago now. I'd never do that again. But that's the thing, like you know, the massive rooms you're in doing like pharmacology and all that's pathophysiology. It's all very important. We need to know it. The skill set of nurses keeps increasing all the time. Like we were, you know, the saying that we used to be like glorified housemaids or whatever, like you just be making beds, glorified cleaners is the term. You know, the things that nurses do, I think a lot of people don't understand until they're in hospital what nurses actually do and the scope of our role. That, I mean, it doesn't happen in community and drug and alcohol, but when I was a ward nurse at RPA, it was so palpable, the amount of usually middle-aged men who, when they were in hospital as a patient, would make the comment to me, and I'm sure many others, they're like, I had no idea what nurses do and you guys are amazing. It's like, thank you. But also, what can I do for you? Let's help you. Let's get you better. But it's just, it's really interesting. Society has this. We're very trusted. I think we're the most trusted profession, but also people really, like, unless they have experience in health, don't have an understanding of what we actually do. But we need more money. Thank you, government. New South Wales, let's go.
Exactly. It's like people don't realise what nurses do, and you're there 24/7, you know, round the clock, the buzzers are going, and especially, you know, we're overworked and understaffed. It's always been that way when I was there. Like, as soon as I qualified, I was stuck in charge of a ward, and it's like, oh my God, you know, and I was so grateful to the enrolled nurse who had been on the ward forever, that she was the backbone, more or less, running the ward, and I was learning from her, because you might do a 2 week stint on a ward and then you're back into your training in school, and you know, you haven't got that experience. So it's a lot to take on.
Totally. And I like your comment about the EN, the enrolled nurse, being kind of the one who knew it all. I think nursing, there's hierarchy, there's necessary hierarchy. I really like the old school uniforms where, like at RPA, we used to have little tabs that were on our collar here that was like, I had a different color for E and R, and you need to know what those differences are. But the remove, I hate with a passion. It's a real judgment of someone's character, the way they treat people in the hierarchy. And like our cleaner at work, Emmy, she is so necessary, as is our receptionist. And to like, I mean, the staff where I work are lovely, but you do see in some workplaces in health where they don't say hi to the cleaner. They don't care about what the receptionist day is like. We need to just, and then the top manager, they matter as well. Like there's a hierarchy of people and we all have different jobs, but everyone we just need to be nice to people. It's like people who are rude to wait staff. It's like, how dare you? And I very harshly judge those people if I ever witness it happening.
Yes, we're all important cogs of the wheel, and we're there to be of service. You know, there's not many people who are willing to wipe someone's bottom after they've been to the loo and so forth. And anyhow, you chose drug and alcohol. So are you seeing a rise in the use of drug and alcohol and in any certain age group since the pandemic?
I don't think so. It's more, I think there's always a similar amount of people using. I think especially in public drug and alcohol, where you're dealing with, primarily heroin use disorder where I work, it often stems from childhood. And everything I say from now is like a generalization, but a reasonable generalization. Most people are using drugs because like there's a spectrum of drug use. So I've used drugs in my life and I've used different drugs because life's been great and I'm out with my friends and I'm having a good time. And luckily I never had a negative reaction. There's risks with everything, drugs and otherwise. But most of the people I work with have used drugs or are using drugs because they've had really, like understatement here, really traumatic childhoods, and it's a coping mechanism for them. And so no judgment for them for doing that. We're all just trying to survive in our own way, and we've all just come from different places and have different options to cope with the stuff that happens in our life. We'll have bad stuff happen, but some people just really kind of had a bum steer in the early years of their life. And I think we need to kind of remove the hierarchy there and be respectful of people who are using drugs, and maybe think about why they might be doing that. I could give some examples, but it's like horrifying stuff that people have frankly survived. And it's no wonder. You hear people's backstories of what happened to them as children, very vulnerable individuals, kids. And then it's like, oh, but now you're an adult. You need to be living in a nice apartment, having a full-time job. It's like they've never been set up for this. So let's help them and be a little bit kind. Back to your actual question. I think more what I notice is just different drugs that are on the market. So during COVID, heroin really disappeared. I think from memory, people were using methamphetamines a lot more or ice, just because you can make that here, whereas heroin is often coming from overseas. More recently, there's something called nitazenes. I don't know if you've heard about these. There's been some New South Wales Health, like public health announcements about it, but buying street drugs like heroin or methamphetamines, people or whoever's making it is all, usually going to cut it with something else. That might be salt, that might be baking powder, it might be fentanyl, which is much stronger than heroin, or it might be nitazenes, which are even stronger than fentanyl. And the risk there is, let's say, for example, I'm off buying some heroin, thinking that it's just heroin. I inject a normal amount, $50 of which is maybe what I usually have, but it's got nitazenes in it. So I'm overdosing and I might die. So there's all these risks, and it's a lot about education. Harm minimization is like my life motto in every aspect of my life. Nobody's perfect. We're not aiming for perfection. We just want to minimize harm. So, like in drug and alcohol, that's things like if someone's buying street heroin and we can get them onto methadone, which is heroin, but it's pharmaceutical grade heroin, you know exactly what you're having. And so then it's safer for you to have your drinking it rather than injecting it. And then you have a team of people, nurses, social workers, doctors, peer workers who can help with other stuff that might be going on, like housing and all the rest. And if you can give someone clean needles, then they're totally mitigating bloodborne virus transmission risk. So it's not like you've got to stop using. It's more, how can we minimize harm to you, keep you safer, while understanding that, things are going on and you can't just turn a switch and make everything stop instantly for everyone. But yeah, not really changes in demographics, but different drugs that you're finding and different things that people are using just because of what's available on the street and on the market.
Right. And you mentioned help and support with housing. What would be a typical client or the most common types of issues that are causing these mental disorders or anxiety, stress, and
Well,
can you give
it's
it?
an interesting. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. You have, like, it can be hard to understand as someone who's grown up in a house and feel safe in a home. But there are some people who don't want to be housed. They actually feel safer being homeless. And, you know, for a long time, I was like, I really struggle understanding that. The idea of not feeling safer out on the street than being able to come to what is my zone, closing the door, locking it and being safe in there. But given people's experiences like abuse and trauma, some people have been held hostage and terrible things have happened to them for days on end. Sometimes people feel like it's like this ability to escape if they're outside, you know, they can move around and they don't have to, like some people, it's also about capacity. You have people with sometimes with significant mental illness or traumatic brain injuries, and maybe they don't have the capacity to be paying for even through Department of Housing or to be organizing their like paying electricity bills or just there's so many factors that go on for so many people. So a real focus for us, and I think, you know, a lot of people in health, is who are you? What's happening for you? And what do you want? What are your goals? Like, it's not about what I want for you so much. I can be concerned about you. People come in all the time with like physical health issues, and we're just a small community. I mean, we're big, but we're a community siloed drug and alcohol unit, not physically attached to a hospital. And sometimes we are the most trusted people or organization in that person's life, which is good that they have that, but also kind of sad that, you know, some drug and alcohol unit is the most trusted service or people that someone has. But we're glad to do that for people. So it's all about like encouraging people to make contact with other services like housing or health and get them to get things sorted that they prioritize. Some people just don't have they're not interested. And you're like, okay, I'm not here to rule your life. I just want to help you with what you want help with. But yeah, it's a fabulous job. And people are great. Most of the people I work with, like clients, are just like lovely, funny, clever humans who've, you know, had things happen and are where they are with us.
It's funny. When I first worked with drug and alcohol in a private clinic, and I was so excited that one person was getting ready for discharge was a heavy alcoholic. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. He's going home, so positive. And then a few weeks later, or a few months later, he was back in. And, you know, the other nurses were sort of laughing at me, going, yeah, we didn't want to take that excitement away from you, but we call it the revolving door. So even if they, you know, can just be in here for a couple of weeks and have 2 weeks where they're alcohol or drug free.
Yeah, that makes a big difference, doesn't it? Yeah. And it's, you know, it's like people coming out of jail, people coming out of rehab clinics. It's like, but where are they going? Are they going back to the same environment they were in? Are they just surrounded by people who are using? You know, do people need to have support networks? So much about life for all of us is, I think, finding your community, which is easier said than done in some cases. But, you know, you need support. People need new people to be around. For some people, that's church. For other people, that's like the festival community. For some people, it might be their local golf group. You know, it's like, but we all of us need to have a community of some description where we feel like safe and connected and just okay to be who we are. And so it can be really tough. People come out of rehab, like with your example, and where are they going? Are they going back to an environment where their partner's drinking or there's domestic violence, or they just don't have setups to make those changes back in their original setting? It's a lot to it.
Exactly. And because you mentioned jail, my first ever job here in Australia before RPA, I was working at Long Bay Prison Hospital.
Right.
And again, I was so naive, and people that were inmates there were coming in with severe drug and alcohol issues. And I was like, well, where are they getting it from? They're inside, you know. It's like, yeah, it's a big market inside, you know. And I just couldn't fathom how they could have so much drug use then inside. And a lot of people, it was like the revolving door. Nobody wanted to leave. Like the ringleaders there did not want to leave because they were big fish in a small pond. They were making loads of money and looking after their family or doing whatever they want, but getting loads of privileges. And that was their community. You know, they were happy there. They go out on the streets. They didn't have that fame, and they didn't have their support network. And it's like,
Yeah.
where do I go? Where do I start? And like you're saying, community is so important, that sense of belonging, because I think it during COVID lockdown, people experienced isolation. I was running health and wellness circles online for over a year every week, because there was people of all backgrounds freaking out, because one, they weren't used to being at home with their partners if they had one, be it lover or husband, and being at home with their children, and then trying to fit in their work shift as well, working from home, looking after their kids, and doing all the household duties and everything else, and they weren't used to it, for some it was an opportunity to grow together as a family, and for others they just all fell apart. But it's, I thought it was a wonderful opportunity to look within, reflect on your life. Where am I now? Where do I want to be? And what's most important in my life? And especially like I think children are the future. And it's about, you can't, I've been talking to some teachers recently, and they're like, people are working long hours, and if the children are misbehaving, it's like, well, what are you doing about it to the teachers? And it's like, well, it starts from home.
Totally,
You're a
yeah.
mother, what do you think?
I just think I think my kids are going to be fine because they get told they're loved every day, and I treat them as individuals. They're their own little people, and they're delightful. And I think it's really hard right now for people because of the cost, the expense of living at the moment, the pressures to be doing. People have to work longer hours to pay the bills, and to kids are in after school care. My older child, who's just in kindy, she's like, I want to go to after school care because my friends are doing it. But we know, and that request is short-lived because she loves hanging out with us as well. But we know that we're so privileged. My household is so privileged because I'm able to work 2 days a week as a nurse, and then I have a side business which is going well and fabulous, and that's excellent. But that's like in addition to, we don't have so many overheads that I have the pressure to go back to work full time. I would hate that. But I'm in a very privileged position where I get to make that choice. And my husband as well, he does a lot of work from home, and he's not full time either, and he does like a multitude of things. So it's like we're able to kind of squish things around, and we'll often do pickup on the days I'm not at work. We'll do pickup and drop off together, which you just don't see parents doing it. It's not that they don't want to do it, they're just frankly unable to do it. The cost of living is insane. And so I'm just thankful every day that I am in a position where I can do that with my kids and spend a lot of time with them, especially when they're little. And working as a nurse, I complain about pay, but we have some conditions that are in our favor, like maternity leave. I was able to take, I just fill a form. I still have my full-time hours, and for 6 years now, because my oldest is six, every 12 months I just fill in a form that says like, what's the issue? I'm like, the issue is that I've got babies. And then it's like, when will this be resolved? Let's recheck in 12 months. And it just means I can do whatever hours I want, which for me is 20, 21 hours. And then in 12 months, I just get to make that decision. Do I want to keep doing 21 hours? But because I've got just a reduced form contract, any day I can say, I want to do 40 hours again. Like, I just have that kind of freedom as a nurse to be able to do that with my hours, which is nice. I know when I had my first baby and you join the mothers group, and there's like, you get to know each other. All these mums and friends of mine who've had babies since, they just have no choice. 12 months hits and they are back full time, and they have 12-month-old babies who are in, or 11 month, 10 months if they took a couple months off before their due date. They're just in full time, long hour daycare. And it's like, it's got to be done, but oh, am I lucky that I get to make that choice to just be home almost all the time, which is really nice. So especially when they're little, and it's lovely. But can I comment on the jail thing that you were talking about? I wanted to comment on a lot of that. So interesting. First of all, I've always had this like weird fascination with like working as a nurse in the jail system. I don't know where that's coming from, but I just think it would be really interesting. And I've heard some not so great stories from nursing staff who've worked in the jail system, but it's just like, I think it would be so fascinating. But your comment about like community and everything, You really notice that. Like, what I had a client who was in jail for 15 years from the age of like from a teenager. So he came out at around age 30. And when you're in the jail system, the rules are so different. Like, you don't make eye contact. If you make eye contact, it means that you want to, have a fight with someone. So that was the example he was telling me. Like, he'd come out age 30 and he'd never used a phone, didn't know how to use the public transport system, because it's just done with, your credit card that's on your phone these days. Totally foreign to him, so felt completely fish out of water. But he also said to me a few times when he came in to see us for dosing, he was like, I just keep almost getting myself in trouble because I'll walk down the street and, if someone's being semi-nice, you make eye contact, you might smile, you just walk past each other. He was like, there's just this intense urge to just fight them when they make eye contact, because those are the rule, like one of the rules that I've lived by for the last 15 years. So I think we need to do so much more. I think Victoria does a better job with like preventing recidivism to jail. Like, they have more programs when people are coming out of jail, exit programs that help with like housing and setting up things like phones that for the rest of us. I mean, I was in uni, I think, when smartphones and the internet came out. So I do remember the time before that, but it's just part of our day to day. And I think we forget how weird that would be to just have that all of a sudden right now, but everyone else is using it. And just be a child, you'd feel so stupid, I think. And so that's a real, there's so many factors that make people go, oh God, it's just easier in jail. I know where I stand, I know what the rules are. But there's all these other day-to-day standard things for us that just add and compile to that issue for people. But did you enjoy working in the jail system?
I did. It was weird at first,
Yeah.
and I was like, I did the training. You do all the admin, go around the offices, see what everybody's doing. So I
Right.
went in all the clinics, and then you have a stint on each of the wards, the
Yeah.
hospital wards. It was scary at first because I'd never walked in somewhere. You've got to be signed in everywhere, and then when that door locks behind you, it's like, oh my God, I'm in this gated area.
Yeah.
And the worst part was when we went into the main yard with all the prisoners who were not, sick,
Yeah.
walking through, my heart was racing. And I think I felt, more secure when you were working on an actual ward and in a clinic because you didn't have that big open space and being in the yard and being vulnerable.
Right.
And I think the prisoners are very privileged because they get to do all sorts of studies. They can do degrees, university degrees, and there's lots of arts and crafts and different types of therapies that they can be doing while they're there. So I think they got that support.
Yeah, and it's great you need that. Like, if people are gonna reintegrate into society, you can't just people, there's got to be consequences for actions. But to just have someone sitting in a cell doing nothing, how are they going to be a productive member of society? It's great that they have this op option and opportunity so that they can come out and hopefully, be happy and do something that fills them with purpose, I suppose.
And I think, many people today are lost and confused and are lacking purpose. They don't know what they want to do with their lives, that they haven't got a reason for living. There's a lot of people suffering with depression and anxiety. Like, while we've been traveling in our camper van around Australia, we've met lots of farmers suffering with depression, and it's like once every 10 days a farmer's committing suicide. But I
Yeah.
know that suicide and depression is on the rise.
Yeah, it's life is not easy. I mean, I don't know what to say about that because I'm just a very happy individual. I don't really have anything to say. Life is very tough for people, and I think it just comes back to community. And like I say, it's so easy to say. Some people have a really hard time finding that. But we've got to find our people and feel supported and be doing work that makes us happy. That's the other thing. Like, both my jobs. And if you want to call parenting a job, my third job, they all just bring me great joy. I'm lucky to have nursing's always been, there's some very tough days, and there's some like long-term traumatic stuff that you deal with depending on the shifts that you're having and the people that you encounter. Some of those people are staff or your managers, but I come home happy, and I'm happy to get up and go to work, even though it's winter now and I'm getting up in the dark at 6 a.m. I don't love that, but work brings me joy. And I know a lot of friends, in the city and elsewhere, who just don't love their job and do it because they have to earn a crust. And once again, lucky me that I'm in a position where my job's great most of the time.
Yeah. Have you noticed any rises or changes with teenagers drinking more alcohol or with adults as well?
Well, I work in so I work in an area where you have to be, so there's a few things to be on our public program. So we have different units. So at the downstairs, physical downstairs unit is our alcohol unit, and we are heroin unit upstairs. But you have to be 18. We've had a few 17-year-olds, but when you do that, the parameters around that is you have to have two like staff specialists, really senior doctors, be doing assessments on the teenager. So we don't really see teenagers. There's kind of other services that are involved with teenagers, but I don't. There's. I mean, if anything, from what I'm seeing, just in my personal life, people are drinking much less these days. And there's so much. The whole rise of non-alcoholic alcohol. I had my first baby 6 years ago. The non-alcoholic wine that I was allowed to have back then tasted terrible. And you can get some really nice things now. The zero alcohol beers, that are just in almost every pub. It's kind of a. That's a signifier of the change in people's desires and what they want to be consuming. I think people are drinking less, would be my guess. And in terms of other drugs, I mean, I don't know. And then we can talk about like what's harmful and what's not harmful. Like alcohol's a pretty harmful drug to self and others because, it increases domestic violence risks and general violence and car accidents when people get behind the wheel. So I think it's a good thing. I love a drink, but I think it's a good thing that we're generally drinking less. I certainly hardly drink anymore. But yeah, I think just people make individual choices, and there's a risk in everything. There's a risk in the first time your kid has peanut butter. There's a risk in if you have a drink and you might have be an alcoholic. You don't know till you have a drink. It might not be in your family history. There's a risk with taking psychedelics. There's risk with everything. And so I think people need, in terms of harm minimization, people need to be informed. I think a real problematic thing is the idea of it's illegal, it's bad, don't do it. It's like, well, that's kind of like saying to teenagers or, young people, don't have sex before marriage. It's like, you can say that, but they're probably going to do it anyway, a bunch of them. So why don't we give them access to contraception, have condoms available, have them have families where they feel comfortable having a conversation about what they're doing? Like, I think a lot of kids or teenagers and kids in their early 20s get into trouble because they don't understand the risks, and because it's so taboo, maybe in their household, it was in my household, to discuss certain things. Like, you couldn't be, some kids can't be open about that. Then they just do things because their friends are doing it and they don't know the risks. I think part of harm minimization is, and pill testing is a big part of that. Yay, pill testing. We need more of that. You've got people who can give you information so you can make an informed choice. Most of the people that have pill testing done will get rid of the drug that they purchased. And if they don't, they're at least having, they know what they've got and they know where they can go. And they're having conversations with people that know what they're talking about. So, we just need more education. And I think just more discussion. There's a lot of black and white thinking. If alcohol, I'm sure if alcohol was to come out today, there's no way it would be legal because it's so bad. And I love it. I love a drink. I love a glass of wine, but it is really harmful stuff for the in the wider community. There's no way that would be legal. And there are drugs that are illegal in New South Wales anywhere, Australia, that are less harmful. And I'm not saying they should be legal, but we need to be open to having a conversation about what is good and bad. And let's just talk about it as a people, if people are interested.
Yeah, I guess it's about changing the mindset and being well educated because, in general, Australia is a boozy culture. I believe from the stats that drinking is on the increase,
Oh, really? Oh, there you go.
I I think it's like people are drinking one or two bottles of wine a night, a lot of people, you
Right.
know, and you know, you'll always have the people who are bingers, you know, going out on weekends, weekend
Yeah.
binges and so forth. And, you know, there's a lot of youth drinking. And yeah, and going back to drugs, different drugs on the streets, and you know, a lot of people are looking to be fixed because we're living in a fast-paced world. We want everything done for us. So people are going to ayahuasca and, you know, various forms of that. They've always been around and they've been swept under the carpet. And, you know, Australia is blessed to be the first country in the world where psilocybin is being given and monitored, and they do it in a safe environment where you're there for 3 weeks, you know, like you mentioned, with the staff and support. And it's you're creating miracles because depression, anxiety is on the rise, and it's about finding the root cause and getting to it.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about the research around psilocybin, but there's one that I'm aware of where, and I'll be like, the stats will be slightly off here, but it's amazing. Like, they had people with terminal depression. So, for example, say me at 40, I've got cancer, I'm going to die within the next year. I'm depressed about that, understandably. I'm terminal, I'm going to die. They took this group of people who were terminally depressed on, a guided trip on psilocybin, magic mushrooms, and it was something like 75% of them just were all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, through this work, just kind of felt okay about this is where I am in life. This is what's going to happen. It's inevitable. This is how I'm going to manage this. I'm feeling not depressed about this anymore. It's like, that's amazing. What person, this age or any age, who realizes they've got terminal cancer is kind of going to be okay with that necessarily. And then just with the assistance of this medication, they're feeling kind of at peace and okay with that. It's amazing. And what a kind of good thing to have at the end of your life to not be so, oh God, it would just be awful. I'm glad I'm not in that position. But yeah, there's wonderful stuff. And there's rhetoric around, oh yeah, but they're drugs and they're bad for you. Maybe they're not. Like, all medications have started off coming from some kind of a plant. So the research around it, I think, is fabulous. It's good that we're doing it.
Great. And, you know, a good way to bring community together is through food. So tell us about your food business and how you
So
got into it.
how it started was, so I make chili crisp. It's the best chili crisp you'll ever try. It's really delicious. But it all started when I had babies. So I think it was after my second child. And I'm a big believer in, like, when they turn one and can eat everything that we're eating, I'm like, I'm not making special meals. I love cooking. Even when I had two under two, and I was very tired, I was like, I'm making dinner at 5 o'clock. I'm getting in that kitchen because it's kind of downtime for me. It's really nice. And it was all sometimes chaotic, but maybe I was holding a baby, but it's like, it's a joyful place for me. I love that I enjoy cooking. But I was like, people all over the world eat all sorts of different things. They're going to eat what I eat, and we'll have great meals, and they'll have a good, understanding of food and a good palate. Except for lots of salt and chili. So I was omitting all of that. And they'd have all the other spices, cumin, cinnamon, all that delicious stuff. But I really miss chili. And so then I was buying chili sauces and chili oils and doing all these things. And one day I just thought, I'm gonna have a go at making my own, because I've done that over the years and made semi-good sauces. Thankfully, whatever I was putting in to make it, I noted down what I was putting in, and it was delicious. And so then every year for Christmas, I was making it for our household. And then every year for Christmas, I always make usually some kind of edible gift. It's something homemade. And usually it's something that's got to be in the fridge. So my fridge is just chockers with all these jars, and I'll hand it to you. And I'm like, Beverly, put this straight in the fridge or it'll go off. Merry Christmas. So this year I was like, this is great. It's shelf stable. What a fabulous gift. And so I gave it to her friends and family that Christmas as part of their present. And a month later, I got two text messages within the span of an hour from people I'd given it to with photos of their empty jars. And one was like, I don't remember what food tastes like without this. And the other one was like, how do I get more? So then I thought, oh, maybe I could do something with this. And slowly, slowly, it's been a really slow burn, which has been good. I've just made it and I sell it to people. And now that one of my children is in school, because they were always at preschool on separate days, now that one's in school, there's 2 days a week where I'm not at work and I can just like go off and make chili and get prepared. I've now got time to go to the markets on the weekend. And we go, and I always knew people just needed to taste it because it's good. But people weren't tasting it when I wasn't at the markets. So now at the markets, it's going great guns. People love it. It makes me really happy. People are really happy. I have a few different varieties. One of the ones I brought out recently is a smoky, it's called Smoky Mama, and it's got no chili in it because I know some people hate chili. Some people also just love it but can't tolerate it. And like one of the comments, my husband runs the stalls usually. One of the comments I got, people are loving it, but this dad came back, he'd bought it the week prior, and he came back and I think he bought more, and he was like, my son is eating his dinner now. Like it's, you know, this real treat for him. He's like, he puts it on and he's actually eating his dinner now. So my kind of MO is mama take care of you. I always have with food, no matter what I'm doing, but also good food is all about good sauce. If you have something delicious to put on, you're making a good meal taste better, and you know, a crappy meal tastes good. So that's that.
That's great, because it reminds me of my days when I was in Nice in France, and I approached a chef who was doing cooking classes at home, and then you get to prepare your food and then eat it. So he was like fully booked doing these seafood courses, and I said, well, I want to book you, but we'll do 10 weeks, different classes of Asian fusion vegan. And he was like, we can't do vegan. I said, well, of course you can do vegan. Every meal you cook, you've got an aspect of vegetables or nuts or grains and so forth. And he was like, I don't think anybody will come. And I said, well, let's test the market. And when people were saying to me, shall I bring some fish or meat? Or should I eat something before I come? I said, no, just come and just see how you go. And we were fully booked the first night, and then we had to extend the numbers because everybody wanted to come. And the way I marketed it was, if you can make this sauce, you can add it to, you know, meat or fish or anything, or just eat as is. And people were going, wow, I feel so full, you know. And then I was helping educate people of the various nutritional values in the vegetables and grains and so forth, and it just went viral. So
that's so good. And that's the way to do it. That's like my kind of activism as well. But I also love Asian food is so good, because generally Asian cultures aren't using a lot of dairy, if any. So you omit the meat and it's vegan. It's just automatically vegan. So it's like, oh my gosh, all Asian food I love so, so, so much. But I think like in terms of like vegan activism and just generally getting people to change their minds, the way I've always done it is kind of like that, where I just like give people what I think is good food. And then if someone makes a comment like, that was the best whatever I've ever had, then I'm like, you know, you just said that about a vegan soup or a vegan burger. And that's a really nice moment, because you're not like, you know, yelling at anyone about their views. And, you know, we all have different priorities in life, and I'm not here to tell anybody what to do, but I really enjoy being vegan morally, or predominantly vegan. But it's great. So for me, the way it started, Mike, because my husband runs events, not so much anymore now we've got little kids, but he was running events. And one of the first ones he did was a hip hop night. And I was like, I want to make food. Can I make food for this? Like, I'll pay for it. It'll be free. It's like good RSA. It'll help with the community vibe. You know, people are having drinks. You want some food in their bellies. Fabulous. He was like, of course. And so I rocked up, and I'd been like, predominantly vegan for a few years, I suppose, but I kind of felt like I should let people know that it's vegan. So I had this free food that I'd lovingly made and spent money on, but I was like, vegan, you know, whatever I'd made, and people refused to try it because it was vegan. I was like, what is wrong with you? It's free food. It's like, you can have delicious meat, delicious vegan. You can also have terrible meat meals and terrible non-meat meals. So I was like kind of shocked and appalled by that. So the lesson learned there many years ago was don't tell people it's vegan, because it's not like an allergen thing that they need to know about. And anyone who is vegan or who has an allergy, you know, it's kind of their responsibility to say, can I ask, is that? And people do that. So then from then on, I have the most amazing moments. Like I'll then we do warehouse parties, and I'm become known as the person who like does the food at these warehouse parties. People love it. Like we'd have people coming up. I knew we were doing a good thing in terms of like the music vibe and the whole vibe. When at like 3 in the morning, when people were leaving, you'd have people who'd had like, you know, were half cut. They'd had a number of drinks, and usually you would just leave. People would make the effort to come up and find, like, I'm obviously part of the crew because I'm standing behind serving food the whole night. They'd come up and find me or find my husband and just be like, that was amazing. Thank you so much. And when you have like, you know, wasted people making sure they thank you before they leave in the wee hours, I was like, this is so nice. This is a really great vibe, and people are looking after each other. But you have really nice moments. Like there was one time where I was doing burgers that night. I usually do pizzas these days, but I was doing burgers that night, and one of the lead singers of the band had had a burger, and then he was like, can I have another one? I was like, of course, you deserve your, he needed to be fed, he was performing. And then he was on his third or fourth burger, and this woman came up, as like 4 or 5 people in a night usually do, and she was like, can I'm really sorry, but can I ask, is anything vegan? And I love that moment because they're obviously vegan, and I get to go like, girl, everything, remember this face, anything I give you is always vegan. And so then they're happy and I'm happy. But this guy downing his third or fourth burger was like halfway through the burger, and he was like with his mouth full, he was like, this is vegan? And I was like, yeah, it's all I do is vegan. And he's like, this is vegan? And so it's just like, it's for me, that's such nice activism. And I don't want to take away from anyone else's activism. Like, there is, I'm forgetting their name, but there's an organization that I really respect. They, in terms of vegan stuff, they're in the city, and they have, oh God, what are they called? They're in the city, and they just have screens set up that are showing you slaughterhouse footage, abattoir footage. And I love that because it's the reality, but also they're not, you are engaging, you are choosing to engage. So people will come and watch it, and then someone from their group of people might go up and say, you know, how are you feeling? And then they'll have a conversation. I love that because people are choosing to be involved, but you're also just like exposing people to the reality, and they can get involved or not. But like when it comes to like soapboxing vegans, people love to hate that. They love to hate us as a community. And even within veganism, people love to be cranky at each other. But generally, like I'm never mad at soapboxing vegans because it's horrifying. Like, you know, people are vegan for many reasons. I'm predominantly vegan for ethical reasons, what we do to animals, which is horrible. So I understand, because I remember in 2011 when I saw the Four Corners Live Export to Indonesia program, I was horrified and could not believe that we were not all up in arms about this and the treatment of animals like abroad. And then I learned at home, it was like a slippery slope of me finding out information, and so much that you're told is just industrial terms. So you're like, oh, organic free range, that's fine. But depending on the term and the organization, it's like, oh, but what does that actually mean? So for me, it was a matter of learning. And I was like, oh God, now I can't eat, now I can't drink milk, now I can't do this. And it's just like very frustrating. So I get everyone's activism, but my personal take is just feed people because it's what I've always done anyway. And they don't need to know it's vegan. And if they ask or make a comment, I can let them know. And it's just nice then, you know, no one wants to be told off. And that would have never worked on me being told off. So I just like to, you know, be kind to animals, but also be kind to the people around me. And people have different priorities, you know, you might be with a partner who just wants to eat pork all day and they're the main cook and it's really hard to get around it. We're all just living our own lives, you know? So I feel like as long as I'm doing what I feel is right, then you know, I'm okay in the world. And we should all
Yeah.
feel the same, I suppose.
I totally agree. And like Brian, my partner, is meat and potatoes. He doesn't eat any
Right.
other vegetables or
Really?
fruit.
Yeah.
And we could share a meal. And
Yeah.
some vegans will say to me, how can you live with him?
I know. I know.
I don't believe in extremists for anything. And I
Yeah.
believe in freedom of choice. And I think it's good to be non-judgmental. You know,
Yeah.
it teaches you to be non-judgmental. And I also believe there's a place for animals in the world. Like we've just bought a farm and we'll have cattle adjusting on there. Cattle are needed, and sheep and other animals, you know, for the land. The land is crying out for them, you know. And doesn't mean to say, people, what I was trying to say was, just because I'm vegan, I'm not against having animals on the land. And just because Brian eats meat, I'm not gonna, destroy my 21-year relationship. It's
Yeah,
like,
totally.
it's,
Because yeah, I
yeah.
wasn't. I've been with my partner for I've been with Dave for 22 years, and it's like neither of us were not eating meat when we started this thing. It's like, can you grow together? Can you be a, you know? It's this ever developing, changing situation, and every day we're making choices. And you know, someday you might make a choice that's different to the day before or the next day, which is why, like, one thing that grinds my gears is people who are like, how long have you been vegan? Like, where's your 100-day chip and blah blah blah? Or I accidentally ate this, I'm back to zero. It's like, just like chill out, you know? We're trying to minimize harm. My husband was eating when I was no longer eating meat in the house. My husband was eating meat, and he'd cook up a bag of kangaroo mints and like add that to all of his meals for a while. It was like a, you know, for him, it was like a slow transition out, and he still eats meat sometimes, but it's like, that's fine. He's living his life. But there's so much stuff that I just think we all need to chill out about. Like, one thing that went around in the vegan community for a while is like, you know, we should refuse to eat at a table with people who are eating meat. It's like, well, how are you going to change anyone's mind if you're just totally removing yourself? They're just going to think you're crazy, you know? So while that may work for some people and it aligns with their morals, like, I'm not kind of begrudging you that, but I just think we need to just, like, you don't know what someone's life is like, and you're not going to change anyone's opinion by, you know, huffing off from a dinner table of your friends.
Yeah, and I just think everything starts with respect and education, because once people were coming to my vegan nights, when they were coming for meals, I'd say, Brian can cook you meat, and you can have a bit of both, and they're like, no, I'll just eat whatever you're eating, because
Yeah,
people liked
nice.
it. And I
Yeah.
found people were amazed at how creative you can be with your cooking, with all the different herbs and spices and
Yeah.
tasting new flavors, rather than having like your steak and just plain potatoes. Now you're having lots of different flavors. And like you're saying with the
Yeah.
Asian food, and it's like about spicing up your life and being
Yeah.
passionate and happy.
Yeah. And
So
if you have some kind of enjoyment in cooking, which thankfully I do, it's like the creativity is endless. 'Cause I obviously didn't stop eating meat because I didn't like it. Some people just don't like it. Lucky them, that makes life easy. But I, you know, cheese is amazing. And so I make my own ricotta, and I've tried making my own cheese, and I'll make things that are you know, all the mock meat stuff that people love to diss. But I find it so funny. It's like, people are like, well, you can't call soy milk milk. You've got to call it some long-winded, ridiculous term. It's like, but we're all okay with face cream. We're all okay with coconut cream. Like, no one has issue with that. And in terms of the whole like mock meat stuff, you don't necessarily eat it every day. It's damn delicious. But we again are okay with, like, people always say, why would you have something that looks like the meat version but isn't? Why don't you just not eat it or have the meat version? It's like, but we're all okay with non-alcoholic beer. I mean, it looks like the original, it tastes like the original. We're okay with that, but we're not okay with a Beyond Meat patty that tastes amazing and you have it occasionally and you're living a good life. But I think deep down, and not that I really care about talking to people who have that opinion about it, but I think deep down, it's like, we know that what we do to animals is horrifying. And sometimes it's easier to be like, oh, this crazy vegan, you know, told me I shouldn't eat meat, so I'm going to eat twice as much meat. It's like, I think deep down, it's easier to be like, well, you suck and your community sucks, rather than, oh, well, maybe they're right, but I'm choosing to still eat my steak. I'm choosing to have the wagyu. I'm choosing to have the chicken. That's your choice. Like, I'm not going to tell you to not do that. But it's this really interesting kind of psychological headspace that people have, where they just love to diss. Or I've had people who realize I'm vegan and they start going on about how much they hate vegans and all this stuff. And I'll let them talk for a while, and then it's like, you just you know, the only person talking about vegans is you right now. Like, I'm not saying anything. I'm not trying to convince you. It's just come up, and you're having a go at me. Like, I'm not the one ranting right now. So it's just, yeah, it's a really curious thing. It's, yeah, I love it, and I find it
Yeah.
fascinating.
It's about choosing your wording, who you're talking to, and we're just people who don't eat meat, so.
And I'm also not good in confrontation, so I don't really want to have an argument about anything. And so I kind of, when people arc up, I just kind of want to be left alone and disappear. But there's different personalities involved, and like, I think that's why, partly why my activism, so to speak, is just like I feed people and I happen to make vegan food, because I don't want to be yelling at you. And you can have feelings, or the way my brain works, like I'll watch something, I'll learn about something, I'll form an opinion, but then 3 months later, there's a lot of stuff going on in my world. 3 months later, I couldn't tell you all of those stats to the percentage. I just know that I feel the way I feel. So for me, having this like debate about things, it doesn't work. I just shut down and I want to go curl up in bed. So I'd rather just be nice to people and live the way I want to live, and you can live the way you want to live.
Exactly. And if there was one thing that you could do to change the world, what would it be?
Can I say two? I think one would be eating less meat. If everyone ate less meat, in terms of harm minimization, just eating, like if you eat meat 3 times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, have it for lunch and dinner. That makes, over your lifespan, that makes a huge change in terms of your health, but also the demand of killing animals in our world. And if you're eating, if you're eating 7 meat dinners a night, maybe drop one or drop two of those. I would love to see that. I love that. So like, not about all or nothing, black and white. It's just minimizing the harm, being nice, eat a few more vegetables. Life's good when you eat vegetables. Beans are amazing and filling, and there's protein in so much stuff. There's protein in so much stuff. We're not lacking protein, people. And the other thing I think is just being kind to people, and maybe a better ability for most people, or for some people, to just be able to imagine what it's like to be in someone else's shoes. I think we're very good as a people at othering, like othering drug and alcohol, othering poor people, othering like right wing, left wing people, whatever it is. There's reasons people think the way they do or act the way they do. And just to be able to go, oh, maybe you've had a rough life, or maybe you're having a terrible day, which is why you didn't go when that light turned green. And I'm guilty of getting cranky on the road as well. Not perfect, but just like to be able to think, well, they're a different person to me. Maybe they're having a bad day, and maybe I can just chill out and be nice about it. So being kinder, eating a little less meat would make me a very happy person.
Fabulous. And as it is a health and wellness show, what is your health and wellness go-to?
Oh, health and wellness go-to. Well, I'm trying to do more exercise now that I have a little bit of time. My husband started going to the gym and doing weights, so I'm doing weights with him. When I get the time to go, it's usually Fridays, which is a nice time for us to hang out together. Health and wellness, oh my God, it spans so much stuff. Like spending more time with my husband, which I haven't been able to do, that helps my health and wellness and happiness. Doing more exercise, eating food that's, I mean, you're inevitably healthy when you're having vegan food, but eating food that makes you happy, like that's part of my health and wellness. And that's like being creative and trying new things and doing a bit of molecular gastronomy and, reverse spherification. That's my health and wellness for up here. But I think just, I don't know, there's so much stuff that contributes to that. I don't think I have a go-to. Eat, cooking. Cooking is my go-to. If I had to pick one, I
Fabulous.
love cooking. Yeah.
And where can people buy your delicious food?
Oh, thank you for asking. So, I'm usually at the Bondi markets every Saturday and Sunday is our aim. But I have an Instagram and I always post when we're there, because sometimes they don't have a spot for you or you might be away. But I'm at Bondi markets every Saturday and Sunday. The Saturday is the farmers markets. It's such a nice vibe down there. There's a guy doing natural wines. There's a Manly Mushrooms. There's just like really, it's a really nice vibe. The community of stall holders is lovely as well. Sunday's good too, but if I was a punter, Saturday is just like, I love it. And you can get your delicious dinner set. I have a website, mamasmoke.com.au is my website, and I will ship all over Australia and I'll ship overseas. You just got to contact me. I'll tell you what the cost is for overseas shipping. And if you're happy to pay it, I'll send it. No dramas. And just this weekend, there's a cafe called the Depot in Bondi, and they put my chili on their menu. It's been like a huge week. I'm so chuffed. And so you can go to the Depot at Bondi, and they will They have a corn fritter. It's not vegan, but it's delicious. There's kimchi on it, some poached eggs. This is the thing about chili crisp. Like, I don't care what you put it on. It's just tasty and you should try it, you know? So yeah, from my website, Bondi Markets, and now there's a menu item at the Depot Bondi, which is very exciting. I bought one and I gave my husband the eggs and then I went to cut into it and just seeing my product on the dish that I was, people are paying for. It was such a lovely moment. And the thing about chili crisp, because I'm busy, I don't know anything about marketing. I frankly don't want to pay for marketing. I just want that slow burn. And so markets have been doing real well. And then to just have these people not even ask, they're like, this is happening. I was like, this is so cool. So just that like slow burn. But yes, website, markets, and I can almost guarantee that you'll love it. It's delicious.
Well, I'll be in Sydney next week and I can't wait to try it.
Ah, amazing.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with the listeners before we leave?
We've covered a lot. It's been a really nice chat, Beverly. And it's like all the talking points that I feel really strongly about. I love my kids. I love cooking. I love making things for people and looking after people. And, life's good.
Wonderful. It's been a really fabulous conversation and keep shining. Oh, yes. You did mention to me in an earlier chat that you get your produce from a farmer's market. Where's that?
Well, so my pro it varies where I get it from. Like, I'm choosy about where I get it from, but it varies depending on how busy I am and how much stock I need to get. So it varies, but I recommend people go down to the Bondi Farmers Market to get their dinner for Saturdays and the week.
Yay. So pay attention, listeners, and reach out to Annie
Yay.
and try her delicious food.
Thank you. Please do.
Okay.